So yes, spin border captured very quickly, although there was an artillery bombardment which aircraft of the Royal Air Force observed, and there was also a bombardment of the fort by those aircraft. However, this was largely ineffective. Elsewhere in the region, there was also a very limited RAF presence, particularly in the Zob, and we'll come back to that briefly as those events largely occur after the ceasefire. For now though, let's come back to the central theatre, the Kurram Valley. Can you just describe the region and sort of environment and what's happening there this time?
The central theatre, the Kurram, or Waziristan and the Kurram. Waziristan is the tribal area which lies to the southwest of Thal, around Banu and Tank are the most important towns within it. But it is the home to the Wazir and Mashud tribes, which are the most warlike tribes on the frontier amongst the whole of the tribes. They are the ones that cause, in the whole of the interwar years between the First and Second Wars, and indeed right back to the First and Second Afghan Wars, the Wazirs and the Mashuds are the heart of tribal trouble on the northwest frontier. And Waziristan is, if anything, even more inhospitable than the Khyber. There are no roads in Waziristan. It is the only communication is up the river valleys, up tracks. It is entirely a rural economy, little patches of labour, of subsistence farming, and the tribes effectively survive by what they can scratch from a living from fields, or from launching a raid into British India in order to go and steal or rob caravans or raise taxes on people trying to cross the borders, which operations are then subsequently punished by the British. And so Waziristan lies to the southwest of Thal, and from Thal, the Kurram Valley runs north up to the Durand line and the frontier. It's about 50 or 60 miles long, running pretty much south up to north from Thal, up to the town of Parachinar, and then on to the border crossing pass at Piwa Kotal. And this was the route that General Roberts, Bobs Roberts, used to invade Afghanistan in the Second Afghan War. He went in through that route to get round to the back door to Kabul. So it offers an alternative to the Khyber for crossing into Afghanistan, or alternatively to cross from Afghanistan back into British India or into the tribal territories. The Afghan commander in this area, or the commander of the Afghan army, was a chap called Nadir Khan. He was aged just 36, so he was one of the youngest of the Afghan commanders. He went on to become the Amir in due course in the late 1920s and early 1930s before he was assassinated. But he is definitely the most able Afghan commander. And right from when the Afghans first invaded in early May, pickets and border posts have been beefing up and strengthening up on the Afghan side of the border, and threatening invasion all the way along the Kurram Valley and down to Waziristan itself. And Khan very much kept the British guessing. He'd strengthen in one area. The British would, the Kurram militia in particular from Parachinar, would send forward a reinforcement up to the border to strengthen the militia permanent border posts. That they'd send regular troops up to strengthen that, normally with machine guns when they had them available, or artillery pieces. The Afghans would pull back from the border post again, and the reinforcements would be pulled back into Parachinar or to Thal if it was further south. And then Khan invaded, crossed the border well to the south of Parachinar, to the west of Thal, down the Ketu River from Mutun, heading basically for central Waziristan on about the 23rd of May, if I recall correctly. And the Waziristan militia evacuated all the border posts instead of sticking it out to defend them. The British didn't have the means of communications or have enough reconnaissance or any ability to actually know where Khan was, so there was no reinforcement. So not only did the Waziristan militia evacuate the border posts, and a number of them then mutinied and either abandoned their rifles and fled into the hills, or more normally, fled into the hills with their rifles. And there was a retreat by the OC of the Waziristan militia, Major Russell, who managed to hold together about a 100 or so loyal members of the militia pull back into central Waziristan and link up with relieving British forces. So the militia in Waziristan basically collapsed and largely went over to the Afghan side. Khan then switches focus and he heads from Tank towards the town of Thar, which is a strategic communications centre. Parachinar and the Kurram are to the north of it. Peshawar and Kohat are to the east. Banu and Tank are to the southwest. But all the lines of communications to those places run through Thar. General Eustace, the commander of the Kohat Kurram forces, is stationed at Thal, and Nadir Khan turns up, and on the 26th of May he lays siege to Thal. He surrounds it completely, cuts Parachinar and the Kurram off from Thal, cuts Thal off from Kohat and Peshawar and the rest of British India, and as I say, lays siege to the place.
It's a remarkable march by Khan. I think it's worth stressing that, because we're obviously going to be focusing on the British side of operations, but this was an impressive march along a route which wasn't really expected to be able to take artillery, which he brought with him.
Yep.
And he did it with complete surprise, really. Must have been quite an unwelcome development for Eustace to find him pitch up at his doorstep via this route. And as you said, completely alters the situation in the Kurram Valley, and he's able to besiege Thal. And in fact, if he'd been slightly more energetic at this point, he could have taken the town.
He could well have done, and there are, you know, there were historians who will say that clearly the course of history would have been different if he had done so. But the British had been, right from when they had been pushing back in the Khyber, they had been starting to reinforce the Kurram and Thal and Waziristan with regular troops. So some of them had been got into the area already, and as those forces had arrived in Thal, a number of them have been pushed up to Parachinar, up the Kurram to the north to Parachinar. So that was also reasonably well stocked with regular troops, amongst whom were 22nd Battery of the Motor Machine Gun Service, who had arrived there in Parachinar in mid-May on the 17th of May, having come from Rawalpindi to Kohat. I digress, because they'd done that before Khan had cut off.
It is important, though, you're right, because it means that whilst there's now a divide between the British forces, those in the vicinity of the Afghan border are strong enough that they're not under the threat of being overwhelmed whilst Thal itself is being besieged.
That's, yes, very much the case. And the siege of Thal and Khan's arrival there was a shock to the British, and that was what then diverted the principal body of those reinforcements, which would have been marching up the Khyber and on to Kabul. They were diverted to go and relieve Thal. And this is where you get the relief of Thal by General Dyer.
Yes, who we won't give his background story, but it is infamous.
Yes, yeah. But he marches to the relief of Thal and successfully relieves Thal at the end of May, beginning of June. But the RAF, of course, were also involved in that relief.
So we've got, sort of almost immediately, there's a realisation that things have the potential to go quite badly wrong. And RAF forces from 31 Squadron are redeployed to Kohat to meet the sort of immediate needs. And these operations are restricted in what they can do because there aren't ground forces outside of the city. But they do make an important contribution. Part of the problem is that the temperature during the day means that they're only really able to operate in the morning, because the heat of the day, the thin air, means that there isn't enough lift for these aircraft to take off unless they run their engine at full power, and at that point they overheat. So we've got this sort of problem of a limited number of aircraft able to operate only of a sort of small part of the day. What they are able to do, first of all, drop messages into Thal, letting them know that a relief force is being organised and is on its way. They're able to attack the Afghan artillery positions, which are bombarding Thal with some success. And whilst the dislocation they cause is only temporary, it does have an effect, and it is important, if nothing else, to the British morale of the soldiers within the fort. There are reconnaissances of the camps, and in fact the camps around Thal are bombed during this period, and are later reported as deserted by flights over the top of them. And the reconnaissance is maintained until the 31st of May, when the relief column is in sort of striking distance of Thal. And arrangements have been made for the aircraft to cooperate with the ground forces in the attack on the 1st of June.
Yes, and essentially on the 1st, the Dyer arrives on the outskirts of Thal and is able to attack both north and south of the city to effectively split the siege open and get through to relieve Eustace in Thal itself. And as he the attack to the south is very much a diversion, but supported from the air. It's the one in the north that does the principal damage as far as Khan is concerned, and Khan starts to pull back from Thal itself, back towards the Afghan border. He gets to a place called Kel, which is about 3 or 4 miles to the northwest of Thal, which has been his main camp his main command centre for the siege. But that's also bombed from the air, and by the time the British actually get ground troops up there, the Afghans have abandoned it, leaving some considerable quantities of booty, according to the reports of the ground forces. We've been speaking of British forces, particularly in relation to the ground forces. It's important, I think, to make sort of 2 points. The first is where they are white British forces, and generally in each brigade, one of the 4 battalions will be white British, and the other 3 battalions will be Indian, of whichever caste, and there are all the castes of India are represented within their army. And that British battalion, in a number of cases, was largely made up of territorial soldiers, which had originally come from the territorial force of 1914, when the British regular battalions serving in India had been shipped back to fight on the Western Front. The territorial battalions were mobilised for overseas service and were sent to India to help fill the gap and take their place. So there are some question marks about the morale of the British forces in both senses of the words, both from the territorials, who effectively had seen themselves as peacetime home service soldiers and had gone out to India and were still being retained there when their fellows who had been fighting on the Western Front had been demobilised and sent home, and also the Indian forces, who frequently had volunteered to go and serve overseas with British forces in Europe, in Mesopotamia in particular, and had performed very gallantly, and were now either scraping towards the bottom of the recruiting pool a little bit, or had recovered from those operations and were therefore perhaps not as enchanted with soldiering as they might have been. So British morale was a bit fragile at various times.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the TAs were far from thrilled to still be out there whilst those back in France were being sent back home. And you're right, for the Indian forces, the new cadres which were being raised weren't necessarily the best, were perhaps not as good as those which had come before, and in some cases hadn't been fully trained, particularly in marksmanship. But before we leave Thal, it's worth noting that the garrison commander himself speaks very highly of the RAF's contribution. He talks about the tribesmen living in dread of aeroplanes. Wherever action was taken by aeroplanes, the enemy dispersed, often abandoning guns and horses. But for the excellent information which you gave, your accurate shooting and bombing, my task would have been infinitely harder. There's a sense that the RAF's contribution is significant to the relief of Thal. And certainly when the relief force arrives at Thal, they're given the distribution of the Afghan forces who are pulling back. So it's, they're certainly given some important intelligence and reconnaissance information. Of course, the sort of ceasefire which comes into effect sort of brings the operations around Thal to sort of almost a premature end. The treaty isn't particularly followed up because of that.
No, not from Thal itself. Thal was aware that the Amir had asked for a ceasefire, and the terms of the ceasefire were that the Afghan forces would pull back to the border, and that British forces, where they were established across the border, could remain in situ. The RAF were allowed to continue flying, both over Afghan territory or otherwise.
And that's interesting because it's a specific clause in the ceasefire agreement, isn't it?
Yep.
Whilst they will stop bombing Afghan positions, they have the right to keep on overflying them and providing reconnaissance information. And so it's quite interesting.
And it's also written into the ceasefire letter that the Afghan regular forces will make every effort to, should an aircraft come down within British Indian territory, within tribal territory, to try and make sure that the tribes are influenced in order to recover the aircrew successfully.